You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the show. Stuart Goldsmith here, and today I am very pleased to be speaking to Jenny Bead, fabulous musical theatre comedian slash musical comedian. What do those things mean? What's the difference between those things? We're about to find out. And my one-time wrestling partner as well. I look back very fondly at those times. I think we start off talking about it in this episode. Jenny is doing a fantastic show at the Edinburgh Festival called The First Pregnant Woman in the World, and she's bringing it to the Underbelly in Bristow Square. I think it's on at 6:55 nightly. You can find everything about it that you need to do by looking in the show notes from here, going to jennybead.co.uk, following her on the socials at jennybead on various things, and or just typing her into Google or the Edinburgh Fringe website. By the time this comes out, I think the festival starts today, so get on it quick. You can come and see me doing a shared illusion just for a week from the 4th to the 11th at Monkey Barrel at lunchtime. But now, without further ado, no extras on this one. We just talked to each other heads off for about an hour and 15, and you've got the lot. This is Jenny Bead. Hello! Hello,
hi,
Jenny
mate.
Bead! I'm so excited to see you because you're my old wrestling buddy.
I know. I feel like we share something very special because
we are
that.
Bonded forever through having done the wrestling together.
Genuinely.
And I don't think I've ever talked about it. I don't think I've talked about it on this because why would it come
up?
But what a special time.
That was still one of the best days of my life, I'd say. Like, I've never known an adrenaline like that. It's so different to gigging adrenaline, isn't
yes.
it? It was insane.
Yes.
You had done some wrestling, though, hadn't you?
No, I don't think I'd done any wrestling. I'd done
gymnastics.
Say that again?
Was it gymnastics you did?
Oh, well, okay, so what happened at the wrestling? And I might have to take this bit out because I don't want anyone to know this. But they very kindly gave me this move to do in which I grabbed onto someone's hand and the ropes and then bounced and flipped over.
I remember it.
And I loved that move. It was simple to do. It looked fantastic. But after the wrestling, people, like three or four people came up to me that night and went, "You were backflipping all over the place." And I'm like, oh, that's the magic of wrestling. Everyone thought I was backflipping all over the place. I did one move holding onto the rope. I did some other bits and bobs, but that was like, I did a sort of a front flip, but it was really easy. And everyone was like, "Whoa, you were backflipping everyone." I went, "Yeah, baby, yeah, I was."
It was, I think, the coolest I've ever felt and the coolest I'll ever feel that day.
Yes. Well, that is a classic comedian way to think about things, isn't it? Well, life will never be that good again.
I've peaked.
So it's great. It's really great to see you. And
you
are
too,
in
you.
A, something I've noticed, that might prove a good jumping off point because you're on your way to Edinburgh with the show with the fascinating. Tell me the title because I don't want to mess it up because it's brilliant.
It's The First Pregnant Woman in the World.
Mwah, absolutely great. Love a title that is a laugh out loud funny title.
Oh, good.
But
thanks.
I did see on your Instagram feed that you were putting up the promo for it and people were congratulating you on being pregnant. And you had to say, the child is 1 year old. This is a show that would have come out pregnant.
Yeah. And also, have you met me? Of course I would not do a maternity shoot announcing my pregnancy.
Well, you say what you like. You have done a maternity shoot.
Yeah, that's
it's
true.
Just not announcing your pregnancy. So tell us about, let's start with the show and Edinburgh as coming and tell us where the show, was it, like, yeah, you tell us where in the life of your show it is. Is that a normal amount of time that you go, the baby is one, I will now do the pregnancy show? That seems unusual.
Possibly. I mean, it's funny. So when I was pregnant during the lockdown, so there were no Edinburghs, I don't think, at the time. But I was like writing stuff down. But also I think, I don't know, as a comedian, you just feel like at some point you're running out of stuff to say, don't you? So when something big happens in your life, you're like, oh, this is a show. And this is where I think some of the title comes from. You know, it is the biggest thing that's ever happened to me. But because pregnancy is so common, it's like, no big deal. No big deal. You're not supposed to like be hung up on it or still be talking about it. Or, you know, it's just not that interesting to so many people. But to me, I'm like, why aren't we all talking about this all the time? This is insane. I can't believe this is happening to everyone. So it's kind of, it's supposed to be very self-aware and playful. But it's also, I guess, in a way, saying up front, this is what the show is. If you're not going to like hearing about this, do not come.
It's the title does all of those things, I think, brilliantly.
Right.
Yes. Oh, because, of course, I mean, that's, you've articulated that in a really fun way, in a very honest way. It's the biggest thing that's ever happened to you. Of course it is.
Yeah. But you become a whole new person. And, like, certainly this word that I had not heard of even since after I had the baby, and Ellie Taylor told me about this word called matrescence, which is the word which it's the changing of you become. It's kind of like puberty, but it's becoming a mother. And that is the biggest change I've ever known. And I can't see that I'll ever have anything as big as that again. And no one tells you about it. No one warns you about it. They warn you about things like, oh, you're going to have a lot of nappies to change and, you know, careful with sleeping. No one tells you, you know, internally how life will never be the same again as you know it. And I mean, you're a parent, you understand that, surely.
Yes. Oh, I can't write about anything else.
Exactly.
I think the way I described it, I'd never heard that word, matrescence. I'm sure that's exactly right. I'm sure there's a sort of a dad version as well.
Yeah.
The way I would describe it to people is that, like, of the things I would say about it at the time, it's like there used to be, there's an obscure X-Men bad guy called Nitro, and his power is he explodes and then reassembles his molecules back together. And I was like, oh, it's like that. You explode, and then in about 2 years, how old's your child?
She's 15 months.
Right, so any month now, you will start to reassemble yourself, but different. You'll go, oh, I'm me again.
Yeah.
And then you'll go, oh, but I'm not me anymore, but I am me. And I think that was my pathetic X-Men inspired attempt to get to the concept of matrescence.
No, I think that's actually a really smart way of doing it. And funnily enough, I remember it was during the pandemic, so we had to go home like an hour or two after the baby was born and could only come in for a few hours a day. So that was sort of hell for everyone, especially because we were in for a while. And I remember afterwards he said that about his heart. He's like, I feel like my heart's been blown into pieces and it's being put back together. But completely, like, changed forever. Each bit of that heart has got that little shiny baby bit on it now that's, you know, and maybe he just didn't want to tell me he was using the Nitro analogy.
Well, maybe. But I think it is, I don't want this to turn into a parenting podcast because.
Sorry, it's so easily could.
No, not at all. What I'm saying is, I'm saying that out loud about myself because I could literally talk to you about parenthood for the entire time. And the thing is, what we found is that our children are six and a half and six and three and a half.
Right.
And I have just started to feel like I'm coming out of the tunnel. So good luck out there.
That's so interesting. But do you know what? It was the first thing I did that made me feel like me after. So I had her in March, and then at the beginning of October, I did a new material gig for Ed, who was working up his tour. And I had 20 minutes and I did just brand new 20 minutes.
Which Ed? Who is it?
Oh, sorry, Ed Gamble.
Ed Gamble, got you. Yeah. I know.
I did his night. I've heard of him. Familiar with. He did, and it was at a metal club in Camden. And I remember I turned up being like, and I'd bear it in mind, I'd supposed to do his gig in July. And it was that, I don't know if you remember, it was a day that there was like heavy rain. My partner was away working. I put the baby into the car with me in this mad rain. My sister was going to meet me at the gig. And I started driving in this torrential rain with the baby in the back, who's like a couple of months. I'm like, what the fuck? What am I doing? No. Went home. Started again in October. And I did 20 minutes of brand new stuff to, you know, a metal crowd. I was like, they don't give a shit about what, you know, my birth and things like that. But it was the first time I was like, oh my God, I feel like the old me again. Like just sort of playing with the crowd and suddenly not giving a shit, really, even though I was very nervous and I did care, sort of, you know, the stakes are suddenly so much lower. And it was the first, and I remember getting home and I was like, oh, okay, I'm in there somewhere. It's just going to take a while to come back.
Yes. Yes.
And I didn't think that stand up was the thing that did that for me, to be honest, until maybe then.
Okay. Talk to me about that. Why didn't you think, what is the thing that does that for you? Is it the music?
I don't know. This is the problem.
Okay. Come on. Let's get into this.
Oh God, we've gone so deep so quick. I don't know. This is, I think, my biggest problem with who I am as a comedian, as a performer, as anything outside now, you know, my personal life. There are so many things that I do and I want to do, and I don't know which. I can never pinpoint. This is the one. This is my best thing. And because of that, I feel like I've been almost held back because of it, because I have been so all over the place.
Oh, this is trying to work it out. You're an inverse triple threat.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Finally, someone said it.
Yes, but if you're really good at all sorts of different types of performing, which one do you pick? And then do you, if you're only good at stand-up, if you're only good at songs, you become a singer. Great, you haven't got stand-up worrying you in the background or vice versa. Yeah.
I mean, that's a very nice way of putting it. I would say sort of like jack of all trades, master of none. But, you know, to an extent, there is that thing of people like to be to put you in a bit of a pigeonhole in this. And also, it's just clarity, so you know where to go. Yeah. You know, so some of my best friends have like Susie Ruffle, one of my best friends in the world. And she is so stand-up. And she's so brilliant at it. And so her climb, it makes, you know, she's been able to just channel it all, knowing what it is that she loves, knowing what it is that she's good at. Whereas I'm like, oh, but I also like singing my songs, and I like writing I like writing scripts, and, you know, there's all these different things. Yeah. So I feel perpetually not being the best at anything because of that. Triple threatness. No, I feel like I can't call myself a triple threat. That's too big.
I mentioned it. I raised it. And also, you do call yourself it in a blurb in an Edinburgh show from years ago.
Oh, yeah, but I think the third thing I mentioned was, singer, comic, fast typist.
Yeah, fair. Okay.
I forgot I did that because I've been playing with a new joke in my show that's just about, you know, I didn't care what sex baby I had. I just needed her to be a triple threat.
Yeah, right. We should say for people, I mean, it's quite a sort of kind of a term is it? I was going to say theatre school, West End, Wendy. What kind of a term is it?
It's musical theatre thing. Yeah, so it's like singing, acting, dancing, I guess.
Gotcha.
So and actually, in a lot of ways, nothing to do with comedy.
Yes, but a threat. The threat being you're a threat to other people in the audition room because you're the one that can do everything.
Yeah,
that's what I understand.
Yes, gotcha. Which I never was, even when I did musical theatre. So it's triple threats. You know them when you see them.
Okay.
But yes. Yeah, so
any actor who had the temerity to have spent 20 years playing the trumpet, like, how dare you? How dare you?
No, because that doesn't count, actually.
Oh, does
actual musical talent sometimes. Well, I think that singing does in musical theatre, but actually, if you can play an instrument, that's less. It's more about getting your leg to hit the ceiling. That's the hardest of the triple threats, I think.
Is it?
I think so. I think that's what it's deemed to be anyway. I think, you know,
oh, it's
there's an argument.
Probably the one that's least quickly fixable.
Exactly, it's the one that you've had.
Yes,
because you need the years and years of having those joints and, you know, those hips and everything changed forever.
Being hit with sticks at drama school and whatever.
Exactly. Okay. Whereas technically, inverted commas, anyone can act.
Yes. Sure. Do we need those inverted commas?
I don't think so, but that's what makes me not that popular. Because that's the other thing. I acted for a long time as well. So,
yes.
But I would say when I'm around actors, I say I'm a comic. When I'm around comics, I say I'm an actor.
Yeah, nice. I think, well, you know, I mean, I think that's... Why do you say that? What are you protecting?
Oh, it's some sort of imposter syndrome, isn't it? It's like this fear of being like... Well, do you know what? It's funny, actually. I did a gig not that long ago and someone bowled in very straight away being like, I can't remember what it was. There was like a good sound system or something. And they're like, oh, what do we need this for? It's not like any of us are singer-songwriters. And I was like, oh, actually, I'm a musical comedian. And he was like, well, of course you are. And I was just like, right. There is still, I think, from being a musical comic, there is still that feeling of you're not a proper comic.
Oh, yes, it's cheating somehow.
Yeah.
I don't think that, but
I know.
But I think that's the idea, isn't it? And in an industry kind of riven by self-doubt, any
exactly.
suggestion that one might not be proper, that's
exactly.
a huge case of imposter syndrome, which is probably, which is itself, the imposter syndrome is probably why that concept exists, because people who can only do stand-up probably feel like imposters because they can't do other stuff, and that's what they mean about guitarists or singers or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So it all comes from a massive place of insecurity for everyone. But yeah, no one's ever happy with their lot, are they?
But you have demonstrable skill. As well as being a very funny comic, you are also a writer of funny songs, and you deliver them really well, which to music which I had assumed was written by you as well, and I see there is a piano behind you. So being a, like...
It's a prop, mate.
it's actually a keyboard, if I wanted to. But, but do you write the music for the songs as well?
I don't write the music. I will go in, I work with a guy called Kevin Frost, who is Boy George's musical director.
Oh my God.
He's amazing. I've been working with him for 10 years, and he's very, very funny himself, and we've just got a shorthand. So I will write the lyrics or something, and often I'll go in with like an idea of a melody for what I want the song to do. And I'll go in and I'll say, I want the song to be in this sort of style. And he'll go, what about this? Give me some chords. And I go, yes. And then together we kind of make it, we build it over that.
God.
And I didn't even know that was a
thing. Is that how, I don't know anything about music and songwriting. Right. That sounds incredible. What a great, like to go, it's sort of, I want it to do this. And they go, what, like this? And you go, yes, that's our thing.
He's a magician. Yeah. I remember in the very first show I did in 2015, I did a sort of show. It was about sort of, it's about feminism and hip hop and like trying to sort of make those two meet in my head, I guess. But it was also very much like my first show. And I was very into Drake at the time. And I remember I went to Kev and I was like, Kev, I need a Drake song. He's like, who's this Drake chap? And I was like, oh, bloody hell. So I played him a couple of songs and suddenly he plays some piano. I'm like, that could have been a Drake track. It was amazing. he's brilliant at what he does.
Okay. So you're kind of like from the show of yours that I've seen, which was Jenny Bead, the musical.
Right. Yes.
Which is, to what extent is that kind of typical of your oeuvre? Do you know what I mean? This is like, it's an hour and it's mostly songs and there's stand up in between. I say it's mostly songs. There's good stand up in between them, but it's not stand up and a couple of songs.
Yeah.
It's songs and stand up around them.
So that was the first time I was like, do you know what? I'm going to try and own this. I think for a long time I was like, oh, I should do fewer songs and really work on the stand-up.
Oh, okay.
And then suddenly I was like, wait a minute, what's the bit that... I back myself as a songwriter, as a comedy songwriter, I do. That's the one thing that, you know, amongst all the things I'm not sure about, I know I can write funny songs. Yes. Sorry if that sounds cocky.
not at all. No, I'm agreeing with you. And my assumption is that of the people who do comedy songs, I guess, I'm not an expert in this at all, but I guess quite a lot of them are existing songs with the words changed. So they're not really writing the songs.
Yeah, which I used to do when I first started out. I did a bit of that. Parody is a very easy way in. And it's certainly where I started. And then you go, actually, I want to, you know, do something else. No hate to people that still do it. In fact, I did do one in my last show. Because it is fun and it's really fucking easy. But yeah, I can't remember where I started with this. I was saying why I thought I was a good songwriter. That's it. So I was like, so if that's the bit that I'm good at, why don't I go to town on that? Why don't I also, instead of shying away from the fact that I'm musical theatre trained, classically trained, you know, why don't I sort of have fun with it? And also, you know, it did come from a place of, I was really into, I suddenly being like, why don't I try and play on the things that makes me different instead of, you know, trying to do what everyone else does?
Isn't that nuts? That's a perennial problem for creative people, you know, specifically comics, actors or anyone.
Yeah.
You go, well, I've got all this special stuff, but I better not.
Exactly. How can I be like everyone else? Yeah.
So this is Jenny Bead, a joy to talk to. I'm so sad that I had to edit out the bit towards the end of this episode where her young child wandered into the room and started chatting, or making noises at least. It was very lovely to see and to hear, but not for the likes of you. Now, as I mentioned before, Jenny's show and information about it can be found at jennybead.co.uk or jump on the Edinburgh Fringe website. It's the first official day of the Fringe if we manage to get this one out on that Thursday night, the 4th. And I've every confidence that Nathan's done so, despite it currently being a week ahead. We're one ahead. We finally achieved it. We've been one ahead for the last 6 weeks. And I tell you what, me and Nathan are frequently high-fiving each other at all of the celebrity comedy industry parties that we attend together. So more from Jenny in just a second. Remember, if you're at the festival, treat yourself kindly. And what better way to do that than by going to see Jenny in The First Pregnant Woman in the World at 6:55 in the Underbelly Bristow Square, or indeed myself at 1:25 daily, but only from the 4th to the 11th. If you're listening, if you were so busy at the Edinburgh Festival that you failed to get round to this until the 12th, then I've got sour news for you, Jack. I'm no longer there, but I hope that everyone is enjoying themselves as much as they possibly can. There's so many fun things happening. I'm absolutely gutted that I can't attend the wrestling this year. I've briefly considered travelling up just for that event, but I can't quite square the kind of climate transport issues. But there we are. More on that afterwards. I'll chat to you with some further reflections on the Edinburgh Festival at the end of this episode. You can support this podcast by going to comedianscomedian.com/insiders to support the pod with whatever monthly donation you deem appropriate. Everybody gets the same stuff, whether you're paying £2 a month or £10 a month, or even more, as people very occasionally do. You can set the monthly donation yourself and everyone gets the same stuff. So that's all at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. I hope to see you at Edinburgh. If you come up to the shows, come and say hello afterwards. I'm doing bits and bobs. I'm running around. Oh, I'll tell you very quickly some of the bits and bobs and things that I'm doing. If I can see them fast enough, I'm doing Laugh Train Home. I'm doing a little set there. I'm doing Comedy for Kids on Friday the 5th. And I'm doing the stand. I'm opening the late show in the stand on Friday the 5th as well. That's a busy day. I'm doing a set at the South Cider for Tom Little on Saturday the 6th. I'm doing a set at Liars and Clowns on the Saturday as well. And then I'm emceeing the Monkey Barrel Late Show on Sunday the 7th. And then I think I drew a line under it and said I'm not going to do any more because I'm going to be running around the place seeing as many things as I possibly can. Now, I did a little micro episode where I'll be telling you, giving you some recommendations and what have you, people that I'm keen to see. I'm trying to sort of fill in some of the gaps in the archive of this podcast by running around madly watching lots of brilliant comedians. I hope you are too. Let's just assume, let's take that as a given and get back to the brilliant and very funny Jenny Bean.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
How does your psychology personally kind of play into that? Is that because it's a means of sort of protecting yourself? And I say that like because it is for me.
Yeah.
It always has been for me. I think I have in the past barked up the wrong tree stand-up wise.
Right.
And whenever I did, I think now it would have been because I needed to feel safe. I would have an idea. This is the classic thing most comics do. You start off with an idea of what a comedian is,
yes,
and you do an impression of that.
Yes. Yeah.
And for different reasons. And I think for me it was so that I would be safe.
That's interesting. Maybe it is a
so
safety
is there,
thing.
Is there a similar, you know, what's your kind of,
I think
what's your apprehension of it all? How do you apprehend comedy and your role in it? Do you, like you mentioned imposter syndrome before,
yeah,
do you feel like
I think that plays
you're playing catch up within it?
Totally. And I think, you know, I feel like with comedy, with I suppose everyone feels this, but unless, you know, you don't get formal training in it. So a bit of me is like, well, I don't know what I'm doing. So this is just me having a go and going along and sort of trying it out as I go. And I feel like there's some people that went to stand-up school and they graduated from stand-up school and now, and they know how to do it. Whereas I feel like I'm still piecing it together. And I think, you know, in my head, I'm still very much like, I didn't go to university. I didn't, you know, I didn't do a lot of things that make me think that I should have, you know, I didn't do the open mic circuit for a long time. I feel like maybe I didn't, you know, I don't know, people talk about like earning their stripes, and I think maybe because I I started working and getting some opportunities off the back of some acting stuff or some online stuff that I did. I thought maybe I cheated that way. And so I got into my head about things like that. But yeah, so I've recently been diagnosed with ADHD. Am I what, the 15th comic to tell you this week?
No, it seems to be pretty prevalent in stand-up comedy. And I am edging closer to getting a diagnosis myself.
Interesting.
And it makes sense of a lot of things. Yeah. But then it's also, as I'm sure you know, very, very seductive to think, oh, wouldn't it be great if all of the terrible decisions I've made weren't my fault somehow? Or, you know, all of the behaviours that people find most exhausting. Wouldn't that be great if I could lay it at the door of somewhere?
Yeah.
So no, I mean, that's my end of it.
Yeah.
Tell me about what it means to you and how it plays into your...
How it plays into, I think, comedy is this feeling of, I've got this feeling of, like, I've never quite achieved. I've been at the precipice of nearly doing some really cool stuff and then never quite getting over it. And having opportunities that I don't fully make the most of. And I think that's where it comes into play because I've gone, I'm doing this. And I start things and I just forget to finish them. You know, I don't have that tunnel vision of if I want to do that, then I've got to finish this. It's just chaos all the time in my head. So I think that is apparently, it's quite a common thing, particularly ADHD in women. You feel like that you haven't fulfilled your potential. That's my excuse anyway, because I'll be like, come on, you have to work harder. It's like, but I am working really hard, just not effectively. So it's this sort of, and I don't know, you listen to, I was listening to the Adam Rowe thing, episode of your show earlier, just because, you know, talking about confidence and things and this sort of single-mindedness. I don't know that I would ever be able to, you know, I would say that in some ways I've been as ambitious as a lot of people, but it just doesn't come out. I've gone on a tangent probably, but
no, not at all. No. This is all absolutely good com stuff.
Right.
This is what we're here for. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm certainly interested in those feelings, which I think a lot of us have. As it pertains to ADHD or not, do you have a diagnosis at the moment?
Yes.
Or is it like you do?
Yeah.
Okay. And I think that it will make, although as much as we're slightly abashed to go, oh God, you said, oh God, I'm the 15th comic. I think it will make a lot of sense in the future.
Yeah, definitely.
When we look back at it, we'll go, oh, one of the things that people with ADHD do is stand-up comedy because of course we prize novelty and being in a different place every night with different people and saying different things.
And work in short bursts.
Totally over and above the kind of cloying concept of imagine going to the same place every day with the same people and doing a job.
Yeah.
God, no. Right. So although that might be it might make a lot of sense to go, oh, yeah, well, of course you would gravitate towards that.
Yeah.
And so would a lot of people. And then we might look at the data and go, Jesus Christ, everyone's got it. Isn't that annoying? Whatever.
Yeah.
But specifically kind of away from that, because I'm not sort of an expert in it by any means. But specifically that notion of not achieving your potential. I think that is a pretty commonly felt, I don't know that I could speak to anyone who would say, well, the thing about me is I've achieved my full potential.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So
I suppose everyone will have that to an extent.
Yeah, well, to an extent. I'm not trying to talk you out of your diagnosis really, of course, but what I mean is I think I'm interested in the idea that, what did you say? A lovely phrase. You said something about like the something chaos of my life or the chaos of my mind. Lots and lots of unfinished projects.
Yeah.
You're very skilled at lots of stuff. You start lots of things and it's hard. And I mean, we need to accept it is hard to get stuff away, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
You have done some very successful stuff. I mean, I've come quite late into your work, but like 10 or 11 years ago, you were doing YouTube. You started doing YouTube videos and you had like 500,000 views.
I had quite a lot of views on them, but that was like 2011, so that was over 10 years ago.
That's the punishing YouTube timer that you can't ever change.
Oh my goodness. And I do not know anything about online now, and that's the other thing, like, you know, you get all these people doing like great stuff online now and I'm like, no idea. It's I feel like I'm too old for that now. But it's I feel like I did it at a good time and it certainly opened some doors.
Okay. They were massively high. Like, tell me about the kind of back end of those videos, because they were just crazy high production values. And
oh, bless you. That's,
you know what I mean? Like,
well, they didn't start that way. So again, that was when I started doing sort of parody stuff. And so I would take songs and change the lyrics. And I would do them in rap, which I don't stand by now. but I guess I thought I was good at it at the time. And it was still in the music that I enjoyed listening to. So in my head, it was like, fine. And so, because again, I used to turn them out pretty quickly. Okay. If it was like off the back of something topical, I guess.
Oh, sure. Yes, there's a lot of kind of reality TV.
Yeah, royal wedding stuff.
Not really aimed at me,
sure.
But kind of like I'm kind of yeah. going, oh, I can tell that this is about a thing that I don't yeah. know. This has been okay. So you were chucking them out quite quickly.
Yeah, and then I mean, and they were doing really well for me, and then I got two into my head, and I sort of stopped
is
doing
that
them.
Why you stopped?
Basically,
talk to me about that.
Well,
because that's what a platform. That's what we're all after, right? The thing
yeah,
it hits.
Yeah, I guess so. I did a couple. I can't even remember the order now. The one that suddenly went really big was the Cheryl Cole one when she got yeah. fired from the X Factor in America. Because they couldn't understand her accent, apparently. Mm. So I did a version of Walk This Way by Aerosmith and Run DMC, but Talk This Way. Yeah. And it went, and I got like a £10 wig, and I filmed this thing in my parents' house, and it went like huge. And I made like, this was when like something would get, there was a little article in The Sun about me or in the Metro or something, because like I'd got 30,000 views or something. So like this was early days of stuff.
Oh my God.
And then it just went really big. And then I did a few more, and then I remember I wrote one, and then I started getting people be like, oh, I'd love to film one. I think these are great. And so like using friends of friends who like would like shoot music videos, which is when they started becoming much better.
Oh, gotcha.
Production.
Okay.
I started working with my friend Eugene McGee, with my friend Dipak Patel, who are great at that sort of thing. And God, sorry, I want to go back on that because that sounds so dismissive. They're great at that sort of thing. Who I work with people who are great.
Don't panic.
Yeah,
don't panic.
Thank you.
It didn't sound dismissive.
Okay, good,
you're criticizing yourself as unnecessary.
That's
you
right.
said nice things about these people.
Yeah, but I feel like I'd like lob them to one. But they were like, you know, directors and editors and people that wanted to do fun stuff, who made things look much bigger and better. And then I think one thing I wrote was about it was off the back of a Justin Bieber song called Boyfriend, and it was this thing about Katy Perry not having a boyfriend was my angle. I can't remember what the angle was. I just wanted to do something with Katy Perry, and I did it, and I got my friend Murray, bless him, who's since done very successful stuff, so it doesn't matter, I'm sure, who spent a lot of time putting this together. And I saw it, I was like, nope, tonally all wrong. I just was like, it's like I'm sort of poking fun in a nasty way as opposed to a nice way, or it certainly came okay. across like that. So I was like, I don't want to do that anymore. And then suddenly I think I got into my head like, oh, wait a minute. How much of this looks like I'm bitter? How much of this looks like I'm not being playful with this? And I just stopped being able to do it. And I got in my head, and every now and then I thought I'd have, and then, do you know what? That also coincided with the time I started doing live stuff. So I guess my energies went towards that.
Yeah.
But in a way I look now, you know, Munya Chihuahua, who does the most incredible okay. topical
oh yes I do
stuff.
Yes, sorry.
And I look at him churn them out like overnight, and he is so brilliant, and I'm like, yeah, that was something that was really fun. And I can see why they were successful, because people love seeing something they instantly understand, and you know, it's sort of like when everything's part of this zeitgeist, it's fun because you all sort of feel part of it. And it's just like I tried to do a lot of topical stuff on stage. And the thing is, with topical stuff on stage as opposed to on the internet, you have longer to play with it. You know, you could still talk about, like, I don't know, I could probably still talk about Daniel Radcliffe fucking a horse now, and people would kind of remember the reference. Whereas, you know, online, if it's not that week, you're like, oh, it's past it, the moment's gone. Okay. So I think I get into my head about that as well. Like, I'd have an idea and I'm like, no, unless I've acted on it straight away, I can't do it. So I suppose I started making a lot of rules for myself that I didn't need, that I think were all kind of fear-based. And suddenly I had some doors open to me, and I was like, oh no, I'm going to fuck it. So I'll just freeze instead. And I think that's sort of what happened in some ways.
Oh, thanks for telling me that. That's like, is that hard to say any of that? Because I feel like...
Yeah, a little bit. I guess I don't admit it. Because
yeah.
because no one likes to admit that they're run by fear, really, do they? But I think that was a huge part of what that was. Yeah.
Do you think now that you were being too hard on yourself?
Yeah.
Or do you think, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. Also, you know, not hard enough in other ways. Like, I think I was, yeah, I think I should have cut myself some slack and realized that you're allowed to get things wrong at the beginning of a career effectively. But at the same time now, do you know what? Fuck it. I'll talk about this as well. I've talked about this on another podcast, but I played Nicki Minaj in something on television and okay. I should not have done that. The fact that I did that will haunt me for the rest of my life, I think. And so in that respect, I'm like, well, no, this is why you have to watch yourself really carefully, because otherwise you'll end up doing things that aren't good choices. So I think, in some ways I'm like, no, I'm glad I towed a line. But in other ways, I'm like, no, I could have definitely been more playful. Also, I think the problem with, you know, at that point, because the production values of these things got really good, you can only call in so many favors. You know, I couldn't go back to then doing it in my bedroom with like just a camcorder facing me and a shit wig. So,
and it's probably hard to imagine how much more expensive in 2011 all of the cameras and green screens and everything that we all take for granted post-pandemic.
Yeah. Like now people are amazing. You know, they teach themselves how to edit with a green screen and like a ring light, and they can do so much great stuff. But at the time I didn't know where to start with any of that really. So yeah, a lot of factors.
Yeah. I think that's really fascinating because you like, I always think that's interesting when someone gets like real kind of movement on something and then stops. And I think that's particularly interesting that you can sort of look back at it now and go, you got really in your head about that. I wonder also if there is, I might be wrong, I wonder if there is a mentality that benefits certain people who knock out loads of stuff. Say it's celebrity kind of spoof or whatever, kind of parodying people. Like you say, kind of having a go at people, but in a hopefully in a playful way.
Yeah.
There's probably a mentality whereby people have a sort of thicker skin for it, or a certain, you know what I mean? I'm sure I've spoken to people on this podcast who I've said, and you kind of went for them there, and they sort of said, yeah, but you know, doesn't matter.
Right. Yeah.
And actually there's sort of people's priorities are different. Certainly now, if you said, oh, look, if you're prepared to slightly stick the knife into this person, you can have 500,000 views and all of the other things now that 500,000 views on YouTube. It's very early days of YouTube. It only been around for 6 years, I think 2005.
True.
So now, like, the whole ecosystem that could grow out of 500,000 views video and all the possibilities and everything, that would be very seductive for some people. And as much as I think, oh, you needn't have got in your head, part of me is like, yep, good for you, standards. Do you know what I mean? Or like, good for you for going, well, something doesn't sit right about
this. I think I'm quite emotionally, like, I'm quite sensitive, I think, to my emotions. I don't know if that even makes sense, but like, I've always been like, if something doesn't sit right, I'm not good at doing it. I remember walking out an audition once, or I've done this a couple of times. They were doing this new, I can't even remember what the TV show is now called, but it involved doing, giving prank calls to people. And I had to give a prank call. They were like, as part of the audition, they were like, so we want you to call this hairdresser and we want you to tell them that, that the Kardashians is coming to London and they want to film in your salon. And I was like, wait, so this is just a nice little independent independent run business. And I'm going to get their hopes up about something to try and get a laugh. And it's like, I'm not doing that. Sorry. I just think that's really mean. And I think there'll be busy people. I don't want to waste their time. I'm not the person for this job. So I've definitely taken myself out of quite a lot of things by being like, nope, doesn't sit right. Which again, I don't regret that bit, but definitely I think, I'm just flitting back to why I stopped doing video things. There's another couple of reasons, I think. I started getting meetings with production companies and things that were like, oh, we can do something. We pitch things. So everyone was like, don't do this for free anymore. This can be a thing. And then, of course, it doesn't happen. Whereas I think what's great now about people and young creators is that they're like, no, the best thing you could do is keep putting it out there. Because, you know, if we know anything about TV companies or the TV industry, nothing works quickly. So don't sit on your material going, oh, we'll do this in this great 6-part show that's never going to happen.
Yes, it's really funny. Even this moment, this conversation will be like 5-10 years from now, it will be a hilariously out of date, trapped in amber moment as we reflect on what YouTube was like 11 years ago. And
so true.
Isn't it good that people are having the means of production for themselves? Yeah. And in the future, it will be so absurdly obvious or completely different, or who knows. But I think that's interesting. One of my assumptions was that before I knew about the kind of tonal aspects of it that you found a turn off, was that you were sort of too early for YouTube. You're too early for YouTube success. And that's, because now, absolutely, if you had that stuff, you would know, well, the game plan is, it remains mine, I do it all myself, and if people want to help, they can help.
Yeah.
If people want to assist and support me, but they don't get to, I'm not going to sell the thing to them because the thing is my thing. We all know that now, it's obvious.
Yeah.
But back then, it's hard to imagine now what that would have felt like to go, hey, you aspiring on newer comedian, have a meeting with these people and they're going to talk about money and wow you in an office and you're going to go, whoa,
oh,
that sounds
God.
Great, and then nothing will happen.
Exactly. And I did not know that. And I was barely a comedian at this point. That's the thing. I hadn't done any live stuff. I'd done like news review, which is what started me doing these videos. And I suddenly signed with Debbie Allen, who like had all these huge comedians. And a month earlier, I was sort of like auditioning, getting sent home after the dance call for Legally Blonde the musical. So like it suddenly was a huge shift and I didn't know what I was doing. And you get really excited and you get ahead of yourself, don't you? And you're like, oh no, sorry, I'm going to be a star. So I won't put this out for free anymore. And then, you learn.
Yeah.
You learn quickly.
Gosh. Making content and then refusing to put it out for free. I remember when back in my street performing days, when all of the Canadians had their own websites.
Oh.
And we were all like, oh, come off it, mate. Do you know what I mean? It was all like, that's a bit keen. Do you know what I mean?
I'm not going to need
absolutely, one of them. Absolutely ludicrous approach to the unknown. I think it's very difficult to maintain and appreciate, it's a thing that we should all do as we become more advancing in years. We should all try and go, no, this scary, weird thing that makes me feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Christ, better get into it.
But
better
we
learn
drag
it,
our
better...
heels. And the older you get, the more you drag your heels. So now, looking at things like TikTok, a few times I've gone, should I get a TikTok account? I'm like, no, of course not. That's a ridiculous idea. But then I'm like, but should I? It's terrifying. And you're like, and apparently someone was telling me that works for TikTok, they're desperate for older creators. We're all
painful,
terrified of it.
Painful meeting.
How
dare
you?
You're technically a geriatric creative now. Yeah,
exactly. Geriatric pregnancy, geriatric creative.
Yes, that's interesting. I do. I mean, I could see you sitting well on TikTok. You can sing and you could do voices and TikTok loves that shit.
Yeah, but I just can't
be
asked to.
That's a TikTok triple threat. Okay. So what can you be asked with? Where are you putting your creative energies at the moment? It's the Edinburgh show.
Yeah.
With a view to, and other stuff. You tell me about other stuff as well. But it's with a view to what? What's the plan for the Edinburgh show?
Good questions, Joe. I don't know. Do you know what? I'll tell you, half the reason I've done this Edinburgh show is because... So I had a great year in 2019. The show you saw, the musical.
Yeah.
I had so much fun doing that. Again, because I think for the first time in ages, I was like, I'm doing this on my terms. I'm doing this with, my strengths and I do, and actually I wanted to write and I still do and I'm trying to and I've started three and I haven't finished any of them. I want to write an actual musical. So I was like, okay, so this, this is a sort of good way into that potentially. And then when everything sort of shut down and then I stopped gigging and then I stopped gigging more because of pregnancy and then having a baby, I think in my head it was like sort of trying to, again, finding this, going back to finding myself again in a way. God, that sounds wanky. But, just like I need... My life has been on, including the pregnancy, I guess, my life has been on hold largely for 2 years. And it's all been about something else and someone else. And I don't regret that, but it is massive. You lose yourself and you're like, what? Am I ever going to be able to do this again? So I feel like it was kind of, okay, let me do another Edinburgh and see where I stand. And then I'll work out what I want to do. And it's interesting because obviously... So when I say I can't be asked for things like TikTok, I think, as a parent, you have less time, don't you? And so you suddenly have to be a lot pickier about what you do. And so I feel like, so now I do things either for money or for creative fulfillment and, I guess a bit of fun. So at the moment, my partner is not working so that I can go to Edinburgh and he's going to be looking after the baby there up there with me. And then he's going to start again when things get quiet. I've got stuff lined up for September. And then in October, he's going to start working again. And the thing is, I'm not bringing in enough money to sustain us in that time. So there's this feeling of I've got to make it worth it. I've got to make it, count. So I guess for this, I want to build on the, I think what it is that I started to accept what I was, that I wasn't a stand-up, and that I wasn't, in some ways, I don't see myself as a musical comedian. I think because I think because the style of music I do is different to typical musical comedy, it feels sometimes a bit other.
Yeah.
And I think because I do these massive high production backing tracks, it feels a bit other. And I guess the people... Oh, fuck.
We can be assured that what we're talking about here when we talk about bad musical comedy is bad musical comedy.
Yes.
So everyone
yes.
knows what bad musical
yeah,
comedy
yeah.
is. And if anyone is offended, then on their behalf, then they're admitting that they do bad musical comedy.
That's a good
we're
point.
We're not talking about musical comedy. Yeah. We're talking about the bad musical
yeah,
comedy.
Exactly. So, and I think that, you know, the reputation that it has, and probably why I've been always trying to distance myself from it in a way, which is some internalized, you know, judgment. But I think so. I think because that this was the first time, 2019 was the first time that I've gone, no, this is what I do. And it is a bit different. And I don't know what to name it, but that's okay. Let's have fun with it. Yeah. People will, you know, enjoy the show. And they did. It went really well. And I think I just want to sort of see if that was a fluke or if actually I can build on this idea of.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I do some proper stand-up.
You do
but
musical theatre comedy, or whatever it is.
Well,
you
yeah,
do
I don't know what it is yet, and I'd love someone yeah. to sort of find a term for it. But, you know, see if I can build on that and do these big shows and, like, big songs with some big stand-up routines. Again, I've gone inverted commas there because I guess they're not full routines, because when you have songs, so many of the punchlines are in the songs that, you know, a lot of the it's not proper... There's more setup than there is setup punchline, setup punchline, setup punchline, because the joke's all ideally one big punchline. So the rhythm's slightly different. But yeah, I just feel like I want to do this and see what happens. And then I'm doing some European dates in September. And then I'd like to, I'd like to write a book about this. I felt like when I was pregnant, I really was like, I want a book that's more honest about pregnancy. And so I had been pregnant for about 12 weeks when I started writing notes for a book, which is like, oh my God, who do I think I am? Generally the first pregnant woman in the world. It's like, this is how you do it. But it's more like, I think people shy away from telling you what it's really like, because if you hear too much, you might not do it.
Yes, for sure. Oh no, I'd certainly relate to that, where you... Like you're walking, or in my case, I'm walking along next to my visibly pregnant partner.
Yeah.
And then we would see people who are pushing a pram, and they would look at us and say positive things. And then when we were in their positions, we're pushing a buggy and we see people who are visibly pregnant.
Yeah.
You think to yourself, should I tell them the truth?
Yeah.
No, I'll say positive things.
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean? You can't possibly say, holy shit. Hang on to your hats.
Yeah.
This is going to be the hardest thing you're ever going to go through.
Yeah. And like, obviously it will come with trigger. Oh God, the other day I was having my hair done and I was in there because I had my colour done and it happened for ages. And I was talking to my hairdresser about what a shit show the birth was, which it really was. It was 68 hours long labour.
Oh,
and it was just like, and it, like I say, it was during the pandemic. God. And so it was awful. And I was sitting there and I was talking like all the gross details and I was like, blah. And she's like, oh my God, my friend's just had a baby and she had it within 20 minutes on the floor. Suddenly the hairdresser working next to her is like, guys, can you just bring it in for a bit? Because my client is 8 months pregnant, who was sitting there and we didn't notice. And it's like, oh God. And she heard all this awful stuff and I feel so guilty. So yes, there's a trigger warning. Like you have to want to hear this stuff. You're like, sure. I'm not going to go up to pregnant people in the street and just sort of start ranting about what will happen to their asshole. But you know, like it's, I think anyway, so yeah, that's why I thought potentially there was a book around it. I don't know. But the thing that I've been doing the most in some ways, or trying to do the most since 2017, is scripts. And I love it. And I actually think that's what I'm best at. So okay. I'm trying to write television scripts now. And I've got lots in development, but not necessarily being made.
Okay. How are you applying your ADHD brain to sitting down and writing scripts?
Right.
Is it firing off loads of ideas, loads of pitches, loads of things, and then struggling to pick on one? Or are there... What are the benefits of the way your brain works?
Oh, this is what... So I'd say the benefits are that So I need deadlines. So basically the best thing about when I get an idea that I back enough and I get excited about enough to write the treatment and send off to people, when I get a production company go, yes, we want to work on you with this, I'm like, great, give me deadlines as much as possible. Tell me when you need something by and I can get that done. It will be at the last minute, but I can get it done. The things that I struggle with are, yeah, like I've got a list of 20 ideas that I haven't done enough with. And that's where I'm like, oh God, you know, you hear about these writers that are prolific and they just churn stuff out and they're like, no, like, and they can work really linearly. And I sort of can't do that, which is why it doesn't necessarily suit me in that respect, but it is the thing that I enjoy doing. I said the two things I enjoy doing these days are doing stand up on stage and writing scripts in my pants at home. So if though, like, you know, I would be happy just doing those two things forever. Cause I really thought I'd give up stand up or I'd do it less because I was like, well, I'm not that good at it. So what's the point? You know, like I'm not making it at this point. I've been in the game long enough and there's lots of young people doing much, much better than me. But then I'm like, no, I really like it. So I will keep doing it.
I think there are lots of, phases. I was thinking about this the other day. There's sort of phases that you go through as a comic, whereby there's an excited phase, and then there's a kind of meeting other excited comics phase, and all riffing and not literally riffing, but all kind of like bouncing off each other's excitement about, God, guys, we're doing it, fucking doing it. Those are some of my happiest memories of the open mic circuit. You're not standing in a circle holding hands saying we're all doing it, but you feel like that. Yeah,
these exactly. are the days of our lives.
Yeah. And then there's a kind of like obviously, there is a sort of a hardening that happens and a kind of a hardening of intention, and also a, like, you stop pinching yourself and not believing this is, oh my God, is this really my job? Because you're getting on with it being your job. And then as one gets older in stand up and having done it now for nearly two decades, I'm sort of going, oh, right. Yeah. There's a sort of a, like, obviously there is a phase of, in any comic's life, people newer than you are going to overtake you or overtake it in inverted. I'm doing inverted commas now. You know, there's a phase whereby you need to adjust to the fact that everyone's trajectory is very different. And then there will be other holdout people like you who you think, well, they've been going longer than me. And I think they're great, but they haven't necessarily made it. And then suddenly they'll make it. And you'll go, all right, I needed that person to not make it, please, because I was kind of sort of tying something onto that.
We were talking about
performing and saying to yourself, and being in an area of being in a phase where you're saying to yourself, well, look, if it was going to happen, it would have happened. And then actually there's the solution to that being to go, well, sure, whatever it is and whatever happened means, or whatever all these weird arbitrary parameters are based on other people and what I see around me. And then there's the fact that, no, I like doing this. Oh, well, you should keep doing it then because you like it.
Yeah.
And like I haven't thought about this for a long time, but I used to have a sort of thought experiment where I would, if I was feeling blue or envious about comedy, I'd think, well, imagine if I was the only comic in the world. And imagine if no one else had discovered the secret that what you could do is think of some funny things, practice saying them, turn up in a room and get given 200 quid for saying them.
Yeah.
Would I do it then? Fuck yes,
yeah.
I would.
Yeah.
So that's all any of us
that's
are really
a really
doing,
good point.
Do you know what I mean? So I laud and celebrate that impetus to go, well, no, I'm going to do that because I enjoy it.
Yeah.
And let's face it, everyone is unhappy. Everyone thinks they could be doing better at what they are.
Yeah.
And even those people who are the people, not everybody's unhappy. Yeah. Falafel is very happy. But the people who are happiest, I think, have an internal quest going on that isn't predicated on kind of outside, like overcoming outside obstacles.
Yes.
They're just in a race with themselves.
Do you know what? That's something that, again, not to bring everything back to motherhood, but that's something that's really given me. I feel suddenly I've spent years being jealous of people's careers and lives because of, you know, what they have and these amazing things they have. And I feel like now, because I'm in this unique position where no one else other than me is the mother of my specific daughter, I don't want to be anywhere else. So it's this nice thing of sort of being like, do you know what? In my personal life, I'm so happy. If that means I'm not getting, you know, if that means the other side of things, I'm not quite where I want to be, I'm fine with that. Like, I still have a nice time. I still have a really nice life. I still earn money doing it. I still, on the whole, have largely lovely gigs. you know, do you know what? Actually, I did. So I did Jenny Bead the musical at the Soho Theatre in April, which is the first time I'd done the Soho, and it was like a big moment because I was like, oh, good. I want like something I wanted, and I felt like I'd sort of, I don't know, not arrived, but like there was like a feeling of like, oh, okay, I'm proper. And my my director Charlie Dinkin, who directed that show, she was with me before the first show, and she asked me like a bunch of questions about half an hour before going on stage. And it was like, what are you most proud of? Name some things you've done that 10 years ago you would be really, really impressed to know that you've done, you know. And all like, I'm trying to remember some of the other questions. I can't remember. They put me in this amazing mindset, and they also made you go, oh no, do you know what? I have done amazing things. Like, there's so much that like a younger Jenny would be like really impressed by. So, but it's so easy to, because you're, you know, because our peers, some of our peers are so successful, it's so easy to turn around, it's so easy to look up at them instead of turning around and looking at the hill you've climbed up already. So I feel like that was a really good thing of going, no, there is success here. It just, you know, like you say, when is it ever enough, I guess. So I feel like it's, in a lot of ways, I feel like I'm at the most at peace with my career at the moment now, because it's not the only thing in my life as it was for a really long time.
Yes, absolutely. It is very healthy to have the crushing weight of a baby to deal with, the crushing perspective of realizing that what is no longer the picture but the frame. That's quite a
good thing. Yeah,
I didn't come up with that. I don't know who did. I wrote a show that basically expressed that sentiment. And like the week before I went out to Edinburgh, someone said, oh, it's like that old saying, you're not the picture, you're the frame. I'm like, you get the fuck out of here. I've spent just a year.
Got an extra 55 minutes now.
That. Exactly. Yeah. I don't need to do the show anymore now. I know that has
That's impressive.
But yeah, so having something else that is more important to you. Yeah. So tell me about your way into it, and tell me about what it serves for you. Like, I don't know many people who are kind of, I was in a drama group when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I knew lots of people who were kind of excited about musical theatre in a way that, like, I think I don't like musicals.
Fair enough.
You know, I can't get through Moana's soundtrack without crying.
Oh,
so, I do like musicals, just the right ones that are kind of easy to engage with.
Yeah.
I find it hard to sit in audiences. So the idea of seeing Rent, for example, I'm like, oh, but what if I don't like it and I'm trapped there?
Yeah.
You know, but so what do you want from those? What excites you about those things as a kid, and what brought you on the route that you've been on? Like, what drove you to want to do the musical theatre stuff, and what drove you to want to step out of that into stand-up?
So I think I was probably quite an annoying kid. I think, again, looking back, if, you know, I've had ADHD all my life, it'd be interesting to know how much of this because of that. But I was hugely energetic and really smart, actually, but I couldn't apply myself, and I had no interest in a lot of things. But singing and stuff like that, it just seemed really fun and dumb and silly. And you're like, oh God, yeah, great. So I suppose, I don't know if it was just like a sort of childhood hobby that got out of hand. But certainly as I got older, it was the sort of thing that, I don't know. It's funny, actually, because I'm not a particularly good singer, but I love it. I think singing something that's really good for your soul. And so... And maybe there is a little aspect of being able to do something that not everyone could do. A lot of people can, but not everyone can. Makes you feel like you've got to not respect it. That sounds wanky, but like you've got to kind of look after it a bit, or you've got to do it. Like, you know, so one of the things, I wish I could play the piano better. I can play it a teeny tiny bit, but barely at all. And I wish I could play it. And I'm always so impressed with pianists, and I'm like, you must, you know, practice, you know, and I know that I'm going to push it on my daughter, like, because it's like, well, I can't learn at this point. I did try in lockdown, and this is too hard. So I feel like, I don't know, I think music is something that is, it's such an escapist thing, and it's so fun. And in comedy, what I love about music is that it's like, I always talk about it, like, you can kind of, it's like getting vegetables into kids' food. Like, you can say, you can get away with saying in some things that maybe I couldn't if I was just saying them in song. Okay, so I think where comedy started getting its appeal from a musical theatre background is that you would, so musical theatre auditions were awful. You would spend a week getting stuff ready. You would pay a pianist to help you practice your stuff. You would take the day off whatever temping job you were doing at the time. And you would sing 16 bars of a song for them to go, no, thank you. And like, it was over in seconds. And, or they'd do the dance call, which was like, I'm not a dancer. Suddenly when I started doing comedy and realized you had, so what you're doing, you know, I suppose it's like any acting, you're constantly waiting for these opportunities that come along so infrequently and are such, that's such a long shot, but still throwing everything into them because that's all you've got to throw stuff at. Suddenly the idea that you can write and do your own stuff and almost take your career into control, into your own hands and give you that aspect of control was incredibly empowering. It's like, oh, this is what's going to stop me going nuts, actually. And I think it probably did. So I think, and some people are great at it. Some people can, you know, do how, I think maybe it is, you know, the different mental makeup that they're able to, you know, wait and wait for the auditions and have a nice time doing other stuff in the meantime. But I was going mad. So as soon as the idea of writing my own stuff and being able to perform on my own terms whenever I wanted effectively, suddenly was like, oh, this is much better. Why does everyone not know about this? I think that was my comedy in, if you see what I mean.
Yes, no, definitely. That's a very familiar idea.
Yeah.
You have the, you're in control of it. You've sort of seized it.
Yeah.
So is that, did you ever experience any kind of nerves transitioning from, I know what the script is, it's someone else's script and someone else's words, to going, hey, this is you.
Yeah.
How did you do that? What would you say to young Jenny Bead to accelerate the process of recognizing who you are as a comic, to getting over those kind of things?
Oh, well, I think one of the biggest lessons one of the things I would say is stop apologizing. Like, because I think early day, you're like basically coming on stage. And I, you know what, even sometimes look back at some of the performances I've done. The recording of what you watched, I look back at that and I go, you're actually a bit apologetic on stage. I don't like that. And I think I've come away from that now, but that was only 2019. Yeah, basically, I think I used to get on stage, be like, I'm so sorry, I'm here. I'll be off soon. Don't worry.
And yes. Okay.
And I think, like, God, the biggest thing, one of the biggest lessons is that confidence, it's all about confidence, isn't it? And like, I remember I learned so much going on tour with Susie Ruffle. I mean, we had the time of our lives as well because we're best mates. But, you know, from a sort of professional point of view, watching her confidence on stage, I used to just sort of do an impression of her sometimes to be like, not like, I didn't start talking in her voice and talking about what it's like to be a working class gay woman. But, you know, I did, you know, I was like, if I do an impression of Susie, or as a stand, you know, a proper stand-up is how I sort of saw it, then I'd get more laughs because you're sort of suddenly, you know, adopting this kind of like swagger almost.
Totally. I think of it as biting down on a gig. Sometimes I forget to bite down.
Yes.
You know, you've just got to get your teeth into them and go, right, here we are. This is what it is. Yeah. And they go, all right, is it? Fair enough.
Yeah. And I think now it changes. So that's what you have to do, I think, before... Now, naturally, because you know, if I've been with a baby all day, those 20 minutes on stage at night, like, oh, I can have fun here. I can, you know, I am naturally more relaxed and naturally more confident. So I don't have to do the impression so much, if you see what I mean. But certainly in the early days, I really did. Well, I didn't realize how much I had to. So I would get so nervous. I would cancel gigs all the time. I would get absolutely, like, I would look for excuses to cancel gigs all the time. And I was dating a comic at the time, Rob, who were still really good mates, and we still bounce ideas off each other all the time. And I remember he'd be like, Jen, you just have to fucking gig. And I'm like, I can't do it. I feel like I'm going to die. So I would book gigs and I'd cancel them.
Yeah.
God. And I would say, just do it, without the fear of failing, I guess, to young Jenny Bead. But also, you know, now when people say it to me, oh, you're so brave, I can't believe you do stand up, you know, you're like, yeah, it is hard, I guess, because you know you're going to be bad at first. But that's because now the large majority of my gigs are really fun and good, I can say that. But at the beginning, when you know that maybe nine out of 10 you're going to really struggle, I think Rob used to say to me, the first 50 gigs are going to be bad. And if they're not, okay. That's a fluke.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I would say something similar to people. I would say if you're starting, don't worry about the results of the first 50 gigs. It doesn't matter if they're good. It doesn't matter if they're bad. It doesn't matter. Just do 50 gigs.
Yeah.
And then we can have a conversation about what it's like now you stand up.
I'd also argue that actually I was on a couple of back feet in some ways as when I started, in that one, you're a musical act and in some places musical acts go down really well, but in most places they're not expecting you and they go, what's this? It's just a bit different. And secondly, I still think at that point it was, and still to this extent, you're still sometimes on the back foot being a woman. Like, and I'm not going to be like, oh, poor me, because I know I'm a very privileged woman, but like, you've just got a couple of sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? Expectations to try and prove before you even are on the same footing as, say, a male one-liner.
ADHD being something of a preoccupation of mine at the moment, and whether I have it or not,
I think you do.
I certainly am benefiting a lot. Say again?
I said I think you do.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have really noticed in talking to you now, you talk how I talk.
Oh, interesting.
And I was described by a friend of mine recently in an email. She said, well, that was like standing in front of a confetti cannon. Because I'm excited by lots of ideas, but there are lots of multiple trains of thought happening at the same time. And it's so funny listening to you talk and going, oh, wow, I think I do this, not to people, but I don't mean to do it to people, but you're thinking six things at once and also being really careful about, I don't want that to come across like that. And there's a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah.
And I think I do that, not so much on this show because I try to be quiet and invisible and all the rest of it because of the sake of the interview, but certainly in chatting to people, I do speak like that. So
interesting.
It is a preoccupation of mine. Whether or not I have it, and I don't have a diagnosis, but if there are 10 basic common brain types, and I've got number 6, and a lot of people call that ADHD, whatever, I'm interested to know how it works and what your strategies are, what things you've developed. Are there things you developed over your life to cope with it?
Well, no, not really. That's the problem, because it's such a new diagnosis. I only got diagnosed a few months ago. And actually, been something that's got much worse since I had a baby. So apparently there's a hormonal link, which is why things suddenly got really bad. So my partner had a job that was filming elsewhere. And so once the baby was a few months, he was up and down, not living here. So I was doing a lot of solo parenting and a lot of sort of, I just suddenly stopped being able to function. Like the amount of things you have to think about all the time. I suddenly was like, why can't I do this? And I think I've always been someone that I've always got parking tickets. I've always had speeding fines. We've got a thing in my relationship where I'm not allowed to press the buttons anymore because I will always book things for the wrong days. I've spent so much money on things that you can't get back, like flights. I've missed flights and oh, we're going to the cinema. Oh, no, sorry, I booked the wrong day. We have to see this instead because it's sold out. So many things like that. I'm just making sure my dog's okay. It's really hot out there. He is. There's so many things like that have happened that it's sort of wear at your self-esteem a bit because you're just like, oh, I'm just shit at stuff. And that's what you sort of start getting. And I've always been bad with money and my parents have always been like, oh, you're bad at that and you're bad at, your friends and your partners are always, well, I better do that because, you'll fuck it up effectively.
Yes. And pre-diagnosis, you felt like you must just be,
shit
not to gender
stuff.
It, but like ditzy or, not good at complicated
exactly.
things.
Exactly. Like,
yeah,
and
right.
I get so easily distracted. Like one of the things that will drive my partner mad is that I will start sentences and I will just flight. I've always sort of lived in my brain. I also have OCD, which I don't talk about as much or at all, to be honest. That's for a whole different podcast, I think. But it does mean that I'm constantly preoccupied. My brain is constantly doing a whole bunch of like firefighting a lot of the time. So that being present is not something that comes very naturally to me. I have to really fight to stay in the room. And like, when I have conversations with people, even in meetings that are important, I'm having to physically fight to say, listen. And it's not because they're boring. It's because something's popped into my head. So it's exhausting.
Man, all of this this. Oh, it's really? Motivating very hard. Yeah, I mean, I've got a post-it note on the fridge that says hydrate the children because I keep forgetting to give them water.
This is the thing.
Not to the extent that they die, but like, I just don't think to bring them. I'm forever, when people come round, it's a running joke in our house, I offer them drinks and I never get around to making them.
Yes.
When my wife leaves the house, when we have to both leave the house, rather than wait for me, because if we've got 5 minutes before we leave, I will start a 10-minute task.
Yes.
And I recommend this as a solution, she, with no anger or frustration, probably a bit of frustration, she says, I'm leaving the house now. And she leaves the door open and she walks out of the house. And I go, fuck, I better come with, and then I come with her and then I'm on time.
That's it.
So I've kind of grown a lot of these strategies over the course of my life.
Without naming it.
With just going, well, I just know that if something comes into my head and I don't immediately make a record of it and write it down and put a notification on it, then it may as well never have been sent to me.
That's the thing. And out of sight, out of mind. I think the thing that... So I've always been like this. And I think the thing that made me suddenly get very stressed about it all was this feeling, like you saying, hydrate the kids. That's my biggest fear, is I lose things and leave things on places all the time. I think my biggest fear is leaving my baby on some, like on a bus or somewhere, or just, or my dog. Now that I've got a baby and a dog, like one's going to slip, surely. And so...
one's going to end up on a bus, mate.
Yeah, exactly.
You've got to strap yourself to the baby. The
so I'm living in that constant fear.
Yeah, but the baby doesn't have a lead.
Exactly.
That's
the baby's
huge
not
error.
Microchipped, which actually is something I would like to look into. But it is, you know, it's such a fear. Suddenly the stakes are higher than normal that I feel like there's, you know, you sort of have to be like hyper-vigilant to try and not let anything slip through the cracks. And that was keeping me up at night. I could not turn my brain off. I've always been a bad sleeper anyway. And I was like, this is mad. So I got diagnosed and I got suggested I should take some pills. And then they're like, you just need to organize a blood test and then we can put you on the pills. And then obviously it's taken me 3 or 4 months and I still haven't organized the blood test. So I am not on the pills yet, but I would like to try them because I think it could help.
I mean, I've seen enough... Yeah, I don't know if you are familiar with ADHD Twitter, or, you know, people go so-and-so Twitter or so-and-so. Oh, my God. Oh, Christ. And if you're not going on TikTok, stay off TikTok because TikTok will diagnose you with ADHD in seconds.
Oh, yeah. I've seen the TikTok ones.
Yeah. So the algorithm of TikTok in particular will direct lots of content at you and it will tell you what you're into without you knowing. And then suddenly you'll go, oh, the stuff I'm looking at TikTok is apparently what I'm into. And all of this stuff seems to be directed at people who have ADHD. And you end up going, fuck.
You know what I mean? I've got ADHD then.
Yeah, exactly. Where did I mention that? Because this is funny now. If I start losing my thread.
This is
going
to be a very hard edit.
I was thinking we should tidy this in the edit. I think maybe it would be more honest to what we're talking about if we don't tidy it in the edit. But so I was mentioning Twitter because the thing I see very often, the algorithm understands me, is people going, I started taking the meds for ADHD and the noise in my head stopped. And oh my God, the rest of you have been living your life like this the whole time. What the fuck?
Yeah.
Whether or not I have it, and I still can't quite bring myself to accept or admit that I have.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm wrong still, maybe I'm just scatty. The thing that is so seductive is the idea of like, you take a pill and the way you think changes.
You become a different person suddenly. You become a productive person.
Yeah.
That's what I am hoping will happen. And everyone's like, it's not, you know, it's not a cure, but it is like, God, wouldn't it be great for when you know you've got a deadline coming or when you're desperately trying to do, and you know, when you've got that sort of feeling of self-loathing because you know you need to do something and you can't bring yourself to do it. Wouldn't it be great to take a pill and you can suddenly do it?
Yeah. Yeah. Let's wrap up. We can come and see you at Edinburgh. When and where are you?
I am on at the Clover Underbelly, Bristow Square.
Oh, the Underbelly Clover in Bristow Square.
Yeah.
I know it. Yes.
Do you? I've
nice
not
room.
Been there.
Nice
I've
room.
Heard it's lovely. I'm excited. It's a 60-seater, I think. I'm on at 6:55 p.m.
Does that get you out of bedtime?
It gets me out of bedtime every single night. Which...
Oh, I'm sorry. It was all they had to offer.
Do you know what? I do wonder if it's going to work. I do wonder if it's going to be me finishing the show at 5 to 8 and running back and her having a later bedtime for the whole month.
Yes.
Because, you know, we'll see. But it will be, I mean, it was certainly going to be a very different type of Edinburgh for me. I've not done you know, like this before. But yeah, previews, I don't know if you're found this, but previews this year, the numbers are really low and this weather's not helping. So yeah, that sold out one that I could have done with you last week.
Yes.
I needed so much.
Yes. And then you were poorly. Yeah. Sorry about that.
No, God, no, I'm sorry.
How many have you got left? How many previews have
I've
you got
I've only got
left?
two.
We're,
London
Previews
left.
We're recording this on the 11th of July. It'll come out in a few weeks.
Oh, so right.
Come out just before Edinburgh.
Oh, okay. So I've got two left at this stage. I'm really hoping to pick up another one at some point.
Okay.
And
so should we come and see you later in the run? Or should we pile in and take advantage?
Do you know
of
what I say? Pile in. I'm
great
at that
attitude.
Point. I'm at that point. It's like what we were talking about. It's suddenly. I think the key is suddenly giving less of a shit. And I'm like, do you know what? This is what it is. It's. I'm not a slick. I will never be too slick a comedian. So you know, it sort of very much is what it is, and we'll have fun regardless. It just, you know, it just might be a bit of. It might not be as smooth as it could be further down the line, but I'd prefer fun people, particularly if people listening to this are comedy fans, aren't they? So I'd much rather. So in that respect, yeah, they're the sort of people I would want at the beginning, to be honest, because then you get the good idea of what works and what doesn't. And
yes,
you know,
yes.
If I do actually, then I need to start taking it more seriously.
And this is the experiment to see whether embracing your musical theatre and not running away and hiding from being a comedian or feeling you have to do it a certain way.
Yeah.
You did that once. You took the leap and it was great. And this is the experiment to find out whether that is replicable.
Yeah, I think so.
I'm sure it is. It sounds like it is.
Oh, thank you. What time are you on there?
1:25 p.m. but only from the 4th to the 11th, because it's much harder to take an entire month out of your children's lives once they are sentient.
Of course.
Yeah, but it's work in progress this year, so
perfect.
Hopefully I come out of Edinburgh with next year's show in the bag.
That's the dream, isn't it?
Have a life for a year and then
enjoy.
Be stressing out.
Yeah. Well, I'll see you up there, I hope.
Yes. Thank you so much, Jenny.
Thank
B.
you. It's been really
last
lovely.
Question. Are you happy?
Yeah, I am, actually. I'm really happy. It's like I was saying earlier, I think it's the motherhood thing is suddenly given me a confidence and made me go, I don't want to be anywhere else. I don't want to be anyone else. You know, I want to be specifically this person's mother now. So if I was anyone else, I wouldn't be that. So yeah, is that cheesy? Probably.
You have officially maitressed.
I have.
So that was Jenny, a joy to talk to, and such a funny reflection. Like in this back catalogue of 400 and Christ knows 11 now, I do a lot of listening, as you know, far more listening than I do in my real life. And in my real life, I talk a lot more like Jenny talks. It was just lovely to get that confetti cannon delivery that I'm sometimes accused of to actually experience someone else doing that. So tremendously fun. Don't forget Jenny's show, The First Pregnant Woman in the World. What a title. It's up there with another favourite from this year, Heidi Reagan, who's a fabulous comic as well. I'm hoping to see her. She is doing a show which I believe is called Heidi Reagan Gives Birth Live on Stage Every Night Guaranteed. I can't remember where it is. It's probably at the Pleasance. I think I've seen her there. But have a search for Heidi Reagan as well. She's a long-term pod fan and soon to be a guest, I hope. So two very different takes on motherhood and babies there, I assume. I mean, it might just be that Heidi Reagan has got absolutely nothing to do with pregnancy and she's just winding everyone up. That's possible too. But nonetheless, get and see those shows. If it's still between the 4th and the 11th of August 2022, come along and see me at the Monkey Barrel and I will see you there. And I look forward to seeing you. No postamble this week because this is the last thing I'm doing. No, it's not. It's the last but one thing I'm doing before I get into holiday mode proper for a week. Before then, I bin off my family and head north. The very last thing I'll be doing is recording the blurbs for the surprise episode 412, which I have just recorded with Bianca Del Rio. If you're a fan of RuPaul's Drag Race, or indeed if you're a fan of the night I got engaged in San Francisco when me and my wife went along to see All Stars Battle of the Season, some sort of RuPaul related thing, and Michelle Visage was supposed to host it and she couldn't make it, and Bianca Del Rio hosted it and absolutely tore the roof off. She is an insult comic. She's extraordinarily funny, and I was very lucky to talk to her earlier today out of character. She's talking to me as Roy Haylock, the person behind Bianca Del Rio, but Roy is not precious at all about when he's Bianca and when he's Roy, and it's a really fun, upbeat, really, really fun conversation. So look forward to that. That's a surprise final one. Before then, I have a break for a month and kind of have a summer and relax after Edinburgh and, you know, gently steam somewhere. That's the plan. So look forward to that next week. Check out that micro episode if you've not already. There's some great recommendations on there, and I will speak to you soon. Enjoy your summer. If you are at Edinburgh, creating Edinburgh, being part of Edinburgh, associated with it in any way whatsoever, please relax, enjoy yourself. It's not that important. It's everything and nothing. And that's my timer, so I'm getting out of here. Goodbye forever. Speak soon.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.